Hello, everyone. Welcome to the California Association of Tactical Officers podcast, where we discuss a variety of SWAT-related topics. We believe tactics are a science, and the art is in how we apply those tactics. My name is Marcus Sprigg.
And I'm Brent Stratton.
And I would like to take a moment to thank Cato Gold sponsors for supporting the work that Cato does throughout California. I would like to thank Aardvark Tactical for their relentless support for Cato for many years. While they may be famous for their excellent customer service, Project 7 armor platform, and Sagine and low-key tactical robots, Aardvark works with teams to deliver custom integrated purpose-built solutions that are designed to protect tactical operators. They find, develop, and manufacture purpose-built products that enhance tactical operator safety. Check them out at aardvarktactical.com. Thank you to Battleboard, a company whose origins were founded by a Marine who was looking for a flexible, durable, and portable map tracking system to coordinate operations on the ground in Afghanistan. Several evolutions later, Battleboard has emerged as an industry leader for those coordinating small and large-scale operations in the field. Veteran-owned and made in America, start your next mission fully prepared with Battleboard. Check them out at battleboard.us. I'd like to thank a long-standing supporter of Cato and our chemical agent program. Founded in 1981, Combined Systems Incorporated is a recognized leader in the design, manufacture, and marketing of security products for the global defense and law enforcement markets. As the premier supplier of less lethal munitions and launching systems, CSI manufactures products for riot control, police tactical teams, corrections officers, and military units. CSI's blue chip customer base includes the U.S. Army, U.S. Marines, U.S. Navy, and the majority of U.S. law enforcement, as well as foreign military and security forces around the world. Check them out at combinedsystems.com. So, hey, in this episode of the Cato podcast, Chris Jenny and I wanted to talk a little bit about plans, about pre-event planning. When should you have a plan? When does it change from a kind of come as you are party to a, I need to write this down and start coordinating this a little bit better. And especially in today's day and age where everything is under such scrutiny and we have the technology now to rewind and watch every facet of an operation, we really need a control, discipline, response. And so what do those plans look like for pre-event stuff? What does it look like during a dynamic event? And what are some of the guidelines that you could use in the field and patrol operations or special events that would be helpful? So what kind of prompted this was a quote attributed to Benjamin Franklin: failing to plan is planning to fail. So think about that for a second. Failing to plan is planning to fail. What are your thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah. So basically he's saying, you know, if you don't consider what the possible outcomes are or what the actions are of the other people that are involved with, you know, whatever you're trying to implement, is that it increases the likelihood of something going wrong or something resulting other than what was intended. And so you leave a lot up to chance if you, you know, don't go through that planning process and share those plans with the other people that are working with you. If you think back to, you know, when Ben Franklin was around, this could be like raising a barn, you know, simple things that.
Is that raising, were, like building the barn or raising with a Z, like burning the barn down?
Either one.
If either one needs a plan. Either one needs a plan.
Exactly. And it's not the only time that we've heard this in history. I mean, President Eisenhower said plans are worthless, but planning is everything.
So Sid used to say that quote to me a lot, and plans are worthless, but planning is everything. It's part of tax science. And I didn't really understand what he meant until I had to do kind of more complicated planning. And then I realized that you can't possibly put everything in the plan, but the process of that planning is what helps you make those decisions and gives you a guideline and a ruler, because you already know what your resources are. You already know what your main tendencies are. And then you can adapt and maneuver in time quicker because you are part of that process. So it doesn't do you any good. It doesn't do you any good to have someone else do the plan and then someone else execute the plan. Like they should be involved.
for me in going through tax science, a couple of takeaways were it helps you build mental models of what can happen, and it forces you to, you know, kind of stray away from the sky is falling scenarios and look at probabilities versus possibilities, because there's a lot of different things that can occur in these incidents. And, you know, we don't want to have 90 page operations plans. We want to keep it a little more concise so that our folks can remember these components and implement the plan, you know, to the best of their ability during, you know, an event or incident. So we want to make sure that we can enumerate those things. But as a, you know, a small unit leader or the incident commander, going through that process of considering other options will help accelerate our decision-making process in the event we're faced with circumstances that were beyond what's in the written plan. Sometimes this comes from experience. If you've kind of been there before and you see the incident as it's unfolding, you can make decisions and give directions in support of the, you know, successful resolution of, you know, whatever crisis you're facing during your incident. Sometimes you don't have the luxury of having had that experience before, but maybe you've read an after action report or a historical account of another event that's occurred. And, you know, in that, you learn the tactics or techniques used by those leaders or those people that were able to prevail under those circumstances. And I think with Eisenhower, this quote, being a military general, he was probably well aware of Field Marshal Helmuth von Moltke's quote, "No plan survives contact with the enemy." What do you think about that one?
Again, a great reminder, right? We can sit at our tables and have the greatest idea ever, but the suspect gets a vote. And every great plan is executed, and then the adversary does something. And whatever that is, generally isn't in the plan, unless it's just compliance, right? So we plan for that resistance. We hope for the compliance. So I like that because it reminds us to be flexible. It reminds us to be engaged as the operation transpires. Just don't count on the plan.
Yeah. And hopefully it prompts or your briefing process allows for some discussion about, you know, what potentially could go wrong, because things inevitably will go wrong. And hopefully the people in your unit or on your team have the experience and the trust to be able to bring up their concerns as well as their suggestions for dealing with or mitigating any of those possible risks or issues.
There's no formula for this. So when you talk about planning, especially say special event planning, there's no formula. So we want to plan for what's probable. We ask for the amount of officers, deputies, barricades. For problems that we anticipate is based on intel, past history, things of that nature. And then we have at least a contingency for the worst thing that can happen. But there's no easy formula for this where we can prepare for a meteor, earthquake, during a fair, right? Like, we're not going to staff for that every day. We have to staff for probable events or worst case events where the risk of failure is so great. And so that's the sweet spot where we're constantly battling with how many people do we need? How many resources do we need? And all those different issues. So, you know, what we look at history, what does history teach us? And there's, you know, we, Chris and I talked a couple basic ones like Dallas.
Yeah. There was a protest in Dallas. And officers were ordered not to wear certain protective gear due to public perception. And while the public perception was kind of the key focus, nobody anticipated that they were going to get ambushed and that ultimately five officers were going to lose their lives in that incident and multiple civilians were injured. It was just a decision that was made about protective equipment. Another example is the vehicle ramming in 2017 in Charlottesville. You know, that was a protest of a political rally, And in that incident, there was not an adequate traffic plan that separated the pedestrians or protesters from vehicular traffic. And we know in California, we went through a stretch where it seemed like, you know, every other farmer's market had somebody driving through those markets intentionally or on accident. What were the measures taken to try and mitigate that unwanted interaction between vehicles and pedestrians?
Unwanted interaction. That's pretty fancy. Yeah. No one wants that.
Collisions.
People lose that. That was a traffic guy talking right there. A SWAT traffic guy. Unwanted interaction. I mean, vehicle assaults. So, you know, and then we think about maybe more epically proportioned tragedies, but rarer, high elevation, like Route 91, where we had tons of planning, tons of resources, and overall, you know, a very good response. Several really kind of set the bar for what the rest of us should have been or should be doing now. But who really prepared for that elevated a position? Had never been done before.
Well, not since Texas Tower.
Well, it's ever Texas.
Yeah. And this was, you know, perpetrated against a concert from a, you know, distance 300, 400 yards away. So certainly wasn't in the plan at that point. But since then, all of us who have similar events should be doing some type of threat assessment and considering, you know, a similar attack and planning accordingly for that. Another one that, you know, doesn't involve a lot of weapons, but is equally or can be equally fatal as any of these other incidents is Astroworld in 2021 with the crowd crush. Being able to effectively move thousands of people with the resources that you have. And sometimes that may be, you know, with, you know, a performer or talent that's sort of adversarial. They may not be trying to assist you. They may not be working against you, but they're not helping the problem. So that is something that you have to plan for some of these events. And that's just a small sample, but they're notable examples. And they're ones that have after action reports that you guys can all go and read and see what some of the takeaways were from each of those incidents.
And then, you know, that leads us to talk a little bit about the ever popular 2013 Hayes versus County of San Diego. The first case that really articulated liability arising from tactical conduct and decisions leading up to the use of force. So what quickly got termed creating your own exigency? What is the conduct prior? And where are you putting your chess pieces in this event? And did you put them in a place that created the problem? And there's a fine line there because we have a duty, you know, to intercede and get the public safe during this event. But are we putting our people in the right place? And did we know where they were? Right. And so Hayes now, of course, is part of use of force laws in California. It's codified in the 835, which is California's use of force laws. And so it's no longer just case law. It's in the penal code. And I suspect versions of that will be in other parts of the country if they're not already. But that also brings about the talk about the basic law enforcement strategy.
Yeah, and that is that we must use a peaceful or least forceful resolution. Our plans must minimize the risk to innocent or uninvolved parties. Our plans must conform to our existing laws and policies, and our plans should conform to community expectations. Is going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but you should have an awareness about, you know, what type of conduct and tactics are going to be acceptable. And, you know, we're not talking about, you know, your tactics on high risk warrants necessarily, but this is, you know, how you go about policing and providing security for your community Easter egg hunt versus a, you know, concert that's going to be attended, you know, by 18 to 25 year olds, where there's going to be a lot of alcohol sold. Like, those have different risks that are present, and that should be evaluated and then staffed accordingly.
Yeah, and that's based on a risk assessment, right? So we have to have intelligence, not just our feelings or our gut, but what does this look like in the past? What does the intel tell us about the crowd size, about the threats? What kind of criminal activity will we see? Is it a politically a charged event? Is it religiously charged? You know, both of those kind of amplify people's emotions and can hijack their reasoning. And then, you know, Chris's favorite, do we have a lack of barriers between pedestrians and vehicles, which, you know, what was the term you used? We don't call those vehicle attacks. What was your term?
What did I say? The unintended interactions.
Unintended interactions. So I want you to write that down, even if you're driving. I want you to write down unintended interactions between vehicles and pedestrians are bad. So if you only take away one thing, I want you to take that away. Unintended interactions are bad.
And there's video of these incidents. You had
lots of vehicles in the crowds.
The Christmas parade in Minnesota. You've got Charlottesville. Again, there's others that are accidental, but this stuff happens all too frequently. And usually it's kind of a porous traffic plan. There's not adequate barriers or staffing to prevent that type of accident or intentional action.
And how do we mitigate all risk of any kind? In this case, we're talking about events, but there's only two ways, right? We prevent it from happening. And that's by using, say, in Chris's unintended interactions, we use vehicle barricades, K-rail, things like that. So we don't have accidents or intentional consequences, right? Accidents or intentional consequences. So the only two ways we manage risk, prevention and mitigation. So we prevent that from happening, or we mitigate the effects of the event if it does take place. And those are the two kind of basic strategies that we have to use. And we do this every day in every single patrol call, in every single contact. We do those two things. How am I going to prevent myself from being attacked? How am I going to prevent the suspect from running away? How am I going to prevent the car from getting away? How am I going to prevent him from getting out of the perimeter? If they do get away, how can I mitigate it? Like, we're constantly battling those two strategies with the limited resources that we may have.
Yeah, let me just stay on this topic for another few moments. And you want to think of risk as an equation. So risk equals the threat times vulnerability. So if you have a low threat and low vulnerabilities because of your physical barriers, the staffing that you have, if you're able to isolate or contain the site where your operation or event is going to happen, like all those are in your favor. And so the risk is decreased. But you know, the less control you have, the more vulnerability you have, and the higher the threat level in that area, whether it's, you know, specific threats or, like, you know, Marcus mentioned, something that's politically charged, religiously charged, emotionally charged, or something that's a stated target, by some actor or group, then obviously the risk goes up. And you need to evaluate those risks, develop a plan accordingly, and before the actual implementation of that plan or your event, you have to do some type of training or rehearsal if you haven't done so already. And those are your three main components of risk assessment and risk management. So evaluating the risks, developing your plan, and conducting the training and implementing your plan.
Which leads us to, when should we have a formal plan? So, you know, most police calls for service don't require a plan. It's 1 to 2 deputies or officers respond to the call. They may request additional assistance as a backup unit. They do a car stop, they do a collision. There's nobody really stops and writes down a plan. But then at some point, some of these rapidly evolving, dynamically unfolding events become perimeters, become searches, becomes crime scenes. Sometimes all of those things at the same time. And your collaborative effort, in the words of our friend Kevin Sear from the North, our polite friend from the North,
Eh?
From the Great White North, eh?
Hoser.
Uses collaborative, right? Most police work is collaborative. No one's in charge of the response. We just kind of swarm it, collaborate it, figure out where the holes are and make it happen.
Yeah.
But at we start off
autonomously. Like some, you know, oftentimes that we handle the calls solo or with two people, very little communication about what we're doing. Sometimes like those events you just described, or it could be even be, you know, a large traffic collision, going back to the traffic theme, in an intersection.
He's obsessed with traffic.
Where you have your collaborative response and people just start taking roles, right? They look for work, what needs to be done. They start filling gaps without a whole lot of direction. And we do that pretty well. But with the more complex incidents, when we have more moving parts,
they need to be coordinated. So in law enforcement, you hear it a lot. We talk about, hey, we need to respond versus react to the suspect, right? And that's how we kind of start teaching ourselves to take the initiative away from the suspect, not be just sucked in and constantly reacting to the suspect. But when you talk about a similar vein, collaborative needs at some point, if it gets complex enough, or you have enough people, or it's rapidly evolving enough, it needs to now be coordinated, right? And that's where we talk about our rule of three, talk about identifying a mission, those kind of things. So
that's where the plan comes in.
Your formal plan is really based on, your span of control. And formal plan, I don't mean you stop on the side of the road, pull out your laptop, and you start filling out an ops plan. It could be a hasty plan, but at some point, as this gets bigger and bigger, requiring more resources, someone's going to write down where the people are, what their job is, what the goal is, and what the end state is. Let's talk about a couple of little rules of thumb for that. So a couple of little rules of thumb, when you're on the side of a road in a field at a parade, and you're like, you know what, this is going to require more than me just hoping that everybody does what I need them to do.
Yeah. So one of the things that I look at is span of control, right? It's kind of where we start. How many personnel are going to be under the command, either, you know, of one person at the incident, or, you know, depending on how large it is, you can have, you know, hundreds of officers working. So span of control. And I'll kind of steer this back towards thinking about something that can just kind of happen on patrol, or, you know, this is a non-SWAT incident, right? This is something that could be driven by some gang detectives or patrol officers. So whenever you have multiple maneuvering elements, like if you have more than two search teams moving simultaneously in the same area, and that can be canine teams, it can be teams without canines, it can be, you know, people in drones, whatever. That combination, whenever you have those elements moving and maneuvering, you want to try and eliminate the blue on blue. You need to implement some command and control, and that's by sharing a plan. Anytime you're using more than two radio channels to monitor or talk on as sort of that incident commander or that supervisor on that scene, that divided attention can make it more difficult to make timely decisions. And therefore, it's important to have a plan. Anytime you have more than seven officers, you know, for some folks, you guys have a larger span of control. You're used to working with 10 or 12. That's fine. But I think for a lot of us, we're smaller. We have four or five, six. That's the size that we're comfortable with. We know that there's been studies on human behavior that says we can retain about a sequence of seven things, you know, in our memory at any one time. And so adding more than, you know, seven bodies that are doing different things in a coordinated way or a collaborative way, they need to be coordinated with that plan. And then this depends on your jurisdiction, but generally whenever there's more than two agencies involved, you should have a plan, because there's going to be different SOPs. You're not going to have that, familiarity that Marcus was describing before about the, you know, officers or deputies going out on patrol. You know, you kind of read off your partners and people you're familiar with, but now that you're working with multiple agencies, you may not have that same familiarity, and therefore you got to get a plan out.
I would highly encourage you, if you're a corporal, patrol supervisor, just somebody who's in charge of one of these patrol responses, even if it all goes well, to write it down. Just write down where everybody was, write down a map, use a command board, a battle board, a piece of paper, do something, and take a picture of it and save it with the event number, report number, whatever it is, because now more than ever, we need to justify why we did what we did and where we put people. And that's generally something that we don't write a report about, especially if it all goes well. No force was used or nothing crazy happened. So just another one of those things that you got to add to what you do. A year, 2 years down the road, you find yourself in court. Hugely valuable, especially when we are a profession and we're trying to tell people, hey, we're good at our craft. And I didn't just wing this one. I had a controlled discipline response. Here's the mission. Here's what we wanted to do. And then if you think about what the component parts of the plan are, a hasty plan all the way to a 37-page, 30,000, a federal one, right? A 30,000 people of special event. They all cover the same thing. They all have a version of a situation, mission, execution, administration, command and control. They all frame the operation, right? And so at minimum, we should be framing the operation for our people over the radio, in person, and on paper. Your thoughts on framing the operation? Because I know you like this one. Thank you, Daryl Evans, by the way.
Yeah. You know, when able, and certainly for anything that's pre-planned, you want to articulate the end state or the objective. Like, what is this going to look like when we're done, or what do we want to accomplish, or what do we want to try and prevent from happening? And you define who the main effort is, who's doing what tasks, and who is in support of those tasks. So it could be the main effort being the search team, and your supporting effort is your containment team. Whatever it is, you need to define those roles so you don't have people collapsing in. You know, when the dog alerts and they start giving commands to take somebody into custody. Just as an example. Also, really important from a command perspective, what the commander wants to have happen. Like, generally, how this plan should be implemented, or what steps should be taken, what considerations need to be done. And equally as important is what the commander does not want to have happen. Sometimes, you know, we have a hard time defining that, but like Marcus has already said, we generally do this on a lot of our patrol calls and our day-to-day operations. And so it's just a matter of looking at those four things at a minimum to push out to your personnel. If you haven't had the time to put together, you know, a formal pre-plan, and you're pushed to distribute a hasty plan, especially for something that's rapidly evolving, you know, we go by the CSTI. You want to define the crime. This is super important for making decisions about use of force. So what are the known crimes that have occurred? Suspect. Or suspects. What's the description? Who are we looking for? Sometimes knowing the suspect by name gets some insight into criminal history. Sometimes all we have is a description and a direction of flight to go on. So we're looking for somebody that's matches those characteristics. Threats. What are the known weapons? What's been said? It can go back to that criminal history again. But the crime and the threats are two important components that help shape our use of force decision making, and it's critically important that information is conveyed to the officers or deputies that are out there looking for or trying to resolve whatever we're dealing with. And then the last part is the incident location. Like, where are we at? Whether it's a target location or a direction of travel for a perimeter, we need to know the terrain and area that we're operating in. And those four things can easily be scratched out on a 3x5 card, take a picture of it, can be texted out to a group. You can give it to a staging manager if you guys use that type of resource, and understand that that CSTI, those four, you know, characteristics or categories, they can change and they need to be, you know, updated through some type of a situational update or a crime broadcast at set increments. Like your first one should be within the first 15 minutes of an incident, and certainly a second one by 30 minutes. And depending on the tempo of your operation, that will dictate what other info you want to put out, but keep using that CSTI and sharing that throughout your operation.
And consider, you know, having people actually acknowledge your updates. So it doesn't have to be everybody, but maybe one person on each portion of the perimeter. If you have them divided up into two or three people, your search team, you know, people that may use force or not use force based upon the intel that you're giving them, because you need to make sure that everyone in the operation is on the same page. That's part of that coordinated. And so even basic patrol functions, like before we start to search, we're going to do a roll call and make sure everybody's in the position they're supposed to be. We're not going to assume that because technology says their car's in a location. We're going to ask, and we're going to make sure they acknowledge it so that they're actively listening to what's going on, and you know that you've created that common operational picture. And just think about how quickly your use of force justifications can flow back and forth. And if everyone on that operation isn't listening or acknowledging, they may not know that and commit your organization to an entirely different direction that may not have been necessary.
Think about the response to a swatting incident, right? It sounds horrible. It says it's at a residence, probably in an area where you're not used to having an event like this happen. People are setting up containment. Again, it's rapidly evolving. And then you gain some information that, you know, an officer's made contact with the resident, says everything is okay, and he or she's coming out on the porch. If the other officers or deputies on that perimeter aren't aware of that person's, you know, imminent exit from the structure, depending on the lighting conditions and the other circumstances, you can have a very bad outcome without conveying that information. So that's something that would need to be pushed out, like in a situational update, and kind of modify your CSTI. And that's also where it's important to define, like, your main effort, you know, who your arrest team is versus your containment team and that supporting effort.
And I think we do that too. I know my agency, we did that. I just didn't know what it was called until I kind of was just more educated. And then I realized that's the, you know, the main effort and the focus of effort, and everybody else subordinates to that, right? So this is really important because everybody thinks their job is the most important, but really it's the main effort. So if the job is to arrest somebody, then everything else is in support of that effort. So if you have limited resources, then you will have to cut some of those resources to focus on the main effort. This really speaks to the scientific justification of why I didn't cover the back, right? Because I didn't have enough people to cover the back. And my main effort was to safely arrest the suspect. And if he got away, then so be it, you know, or whatever those choices, those dilemmas that you get forced into when you don't have enough resources. Any final thoughts, Chris? We just kind of wanted to talk briefly about some of those component parts, get you thinking about those. If you have any feedback or prompted you to ask more questions, reach out to us, podcast@catotraining.org. A lot of this stuff we cover in our critical incident leadership classes, our SWAT team leader, our SWAT commander classes. We kind of delve into a little bit more of the mechanics. Any final thoughts, Chris? Thanks for joining me, by the way.
Yeah, gladly. I'll throw out one other thing just for the leaders that are listening to the podcast. Remember that conveying your plan to the people that are you know, working for you or trying to resolve this object or, you know, whatever the incident is, that pushing that plan out helps to decentralize leadership. And it allows those subordinate leaders or those maneuver elements, those officers and deputies that are working to resolve this incident to make decisions in a timely manner and support the overall objective rather than going through the mother may I process of constantly asking permission and making incremental decisions. Obviously that's situation dependent, but generally your plans should convey a certain number of expectations. If you're looking for resources for pre-planned events and where you should start with that, PERF has a guide, Managing Major Events, Best Practices from the Field. PERF also put out Handling Large Pre-Planned Events, Recommendations from Preparations for the 2016 National Political Conventions. We have the US DOJ put out Planning and Managing Security for Major Special Events, Guidelines for Law Enforcement. And, you know, those are probably three nationally distributed resources, all freely available on the internet that you guys can use that have a series of checklists. At a minimum, you should do your SWOT analysis, looking at your strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and threats for any event or operation. Obviously, in California, the use of some type of threat matrix for risk assessment has been common for the service of search warrants or SWAT-related operations. Some version of that can trickle down to these patrol-initiated events just to help with some of the considerations that you're expected to make. You know, that your chief or sheriff has said, hey, I want you to think about these things before you go, you know, acting on our behalf. So don't feel like you have to make this up from scratch. There's lots of info out there, lots of resources that are available. And, you know, be a student in your profession.
Yeah. And if you listen to the podcast at all, you'll hear one of our sponsors is Battleboard. We like Battleboard because it's super versatile. Command Board is out there too, and we like their product as well. But I like Battleboard because it's versatile. I can just slide other pieces of paper in there and rain or shine and coordinate this response. If you're looking to up your game, Battleboard has given us a discount code, and it's Cato2024, Cato2024. And Daniel over at Battleboard makes them in America. He's just trying to help us do a better job. So thanks for joining us. Thank you, Chris, for your time. As always, if you got something out of this, please share it with somebody else, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to the Cato Podcast. To become a member of Cato, check out our website at catotraining.org. If you have a topic suggestion, please send them to podcast@catotraining.org. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend and rate us on the platform of your choice.